This started, you mentioned 2021. I started with a collage that was basically made by the Pacific Music Festival. And I put it out on the internet. I just screenshot like the whole faculty. I didn't make anything myself. They did it. And it was like one woman and some huge number of faculty members. And this is funny because I had been kind of talking about this stuff, and I've been certainly talking about the Pacific Music Festival, and nobody cared. And somehow I just put those pictures up there and it blew up, and there was this huge response. And I was like, really? You guys are surprised by this? You find this unacceptable? Like, I found that ex unacceptable forever. I've known about this forever. But somehow when people see it laid out without words, I think words can be sort of offensive and threatening to people sometimes, but just the picture allows people to see what they want to see, right? It's easy for me as a white woman to see, oh, look, there are no men. But very many of these collages also, there are all kinds of other people missing too, right? You have a huge lack of gender diverse people. You have very few black and brown people in these photos commonly as well. So just putting these collages out there allows people to kind of see themselves or the lack of themselves. And somehow, I think it's a little less threatening. And so when I started these collages, that was before I started using words. Now I'm much more threatening with words. But this was my toe in the water, these collages.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman, which I hope inspires you through the personal stories of a diversity of musicians with in-depth conversations and great music that reveal the depth and breadth to a life in music. Catherine Needleman is a wonderful oboe player who's been the principal oboist of the Baltimore Symphony since 2003. She's also active as a soloist and chamber musician and is on faculty at the Curtis Institute of Music. She's a champion of music of our time, and you'll find her recordings and many projects on her website. To many listeners in the classical music world, she's probably better known for her Substack articles and posts on social media that address misogyny, sexual misconduct and assault, and the lack of diversity and equity in the classical music world. In this conversation, you'll hear about some of her activism and advocacy work, and different aspects of Catherine's life as a musician, including her work as a composer and educator, and mentors including Jennifer Higdon. Please note the timestamps to navigate the episode. I regret that I didn't get into improvisation with her, because she's also an excellent improviser and has put out an album of improvised chamber music, The Marmalade Balloon. Perhaps we can get into this next time she comes on the podcast. You can watch this on YouTube or listen to the podcast, and I've also linked the transcript to my website, leahroseman.com. It's a joy to bring these inspiring episodes to you every week, and I do all the many jobs of research, production, and publicity. Please look at the links for different ways to support this independent podcast. In January 2025, I'll be releasing season 5 of this series. In the show notes for this episode, I've linked some other episodes that may interest you, as well as the newsletter sign up, where you'll get access to exclusive information about upcoming guests. Now to Catherine Needleman. Hi, Catherine. Thanks so much for joining me here today.
Hi, it's great to be here.
I don't normally divulge who I'm going to be interviewing, but I couldn't resist with you. So, so many of my colleagues follow you and appreciate the work you do as an advocate. So I did mention it to a few people and they were just so excited.
Oh, well, I'm excited to be here.
A lot of people are so appreciative of the work you do as an advocate and a writer, and we're definitely going to be talking about that.
Okay.
And people know you're an oboist, but I don't think everyone knows you're a composer or some of the other work you do.
Yeah, I wear some different hats sometimes. I'm kind of new-ish to composing, but also not. I did it really since I was a small child, and then I just kind of lived as an improviser for many decades. That's sort of what I do for fun. Usually not on the oboe because the oboe is a little bit limited harmonically. But I play the piano for fun. That's like my hobby. So. I've been doing that forever, and I think that growing up in this with this canon of music just by men, it kind of never occurred to me that, well, I could put music on paper too. And then during the pandemic, it occurred to me. And so I actually really enjoy that. It's one of the more satisfying to me things that I do.
Yeah, so a lot of this work you have done, your advocacy work, you started during the pandemic, right?
I think you could say that. Yes. I think that's fair.
Yeah, I can relate because with this podcast and other stuff I've done, it's like I started when we had
less to do as orchestra musicians. And then it kind of, you know, got out of control. And now I have to fit everything in.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's hard to describe exactly what I am and what I do now. But it was definitely a process to get here. The pandemic was a big part of it. Yes, because we had this free time. And I think I first started getting some attention with the things that I post in the pandemic. But certainly I wouldn't say that it just started there. There was definitely a lead in.
Yeah. No, but in terms of all the attention you've garnered, the amount of followers you have, your blog and all that, that was during like 2021?
Yes, I believe that's about right. I started really posting kind of some overtly feminist stuff in about 2021.
Well, let's start with some good news. So you've started this fund for new music creation.
Yes.
And the story is kind of interesting because it relates to your student, Fatima. Do you want right. to tell that story?
Sure. So I would say I've always been hearing, at least since I've been kind of out on the internet, that the reason that we don't see women in all of these different spaces that I complain about, the reason is there's a pipeline problem. And this means that we don't have the students, right? Or that we're not nurturing the talent in this so-called pipeline. And I am quite sure that that is an erroneous argument at this point, because it's so obvious to me how many wonderful women there are ready to go. And not just women, you know, people of other genders and people who are not white, right? There are all these people who are ready to go at the highest level. And it's not because they don't exist that we don't see them. It's because the system is a bit stacked against them. I think this is more accurate. Anyway, I had complained about a brass ensemble online that was very, very disproportionately white men. And the man in charge was quite offended by what I had to say, and he wanted to speak to me. This was back when I would agree to speak to people sort of on a cold call, which I no longer do. And I should have known, I shouldn't have done it, because there were so many red flags in the communication, the written communication that he gave me, but I was stupid then. And so I spoke to him, and I should say he spoke to me, and it was a 45-minute conversation. I timed it, during which he spoke for 43 and a half minutes. And I had to ask permission to speak. I had to interrupt him in order to speak. I had to say, can you please let me finish, in order to say the very few things that I said. But this was his big thing, that it's the pipeline. And this is why, you know, the women brass players weren't in this very high class brass ensemble, because there just simply weren't any who were good enough. And he knows how everybody plays in the whole world. And, you know, they're just not, he would love to invite women. He loves women, but just that they haven't been on the pipeline, and we really need to focus on that pipeline. He, of course, didn't put forth any way that he had planned to focus on that pipeline and fix this so-called problem of not knowing these women brass players. But I thought to him, well, maybe this is the issue. I thought to myself, maybe this is right. Maybe this is the issue with oboe. Like, I know about oboe. And maybe we don't see these women in the highest echelons of oboe because they just haven't been trained appropriately, right? And they're not here ready to go. And so I opened up a scholarship for free online lessons to anybody in the world. And I said, you have to speak English or Spanish, because otherwise I can't communicate with you. I'm sorry. And I got two young women students who were phenomenal. One of them stayed with me. She asked to stay for a second year. And her name is Fatima Landa. And she is remarkable. I could kind of smell her fire through the internet in a conversation just like this. And, you know, she spoke no English at the time, and my Spanish is not particularly good. It's kind of all right, but it's not, I can't have a conversation like this one in Spanish. But I could still smell her fire and her drive. And she, you know, she hadn't had really any training to speak of. And so we engaged in a couple years of online training, and she came here after about 8 months. Valerie Coleman was instrumental in getting her here to the United States for the summer, and she went to Booty Tanglewood. And Valerie really arranged a full scholarship for her. And we needed to get some money together to get her here. So I did a GoFundMe for that, and I ended up with a little bit of extra money. I bought her some reed tools and stuff like that. And she showed up to my house, and I was able to teach her in a room for the first time ever. And it was unbelievable to me because the stuff she was playing was unplayable. And I had been working like, oh, let's try this control issue. You know, I was really struggling with this intonation thing or this control thing. But when I had her stuff, I couldn't do anything at all with it, right? This is how lucky I am with my equipment and the ability to afford decent equipment. And she was just playing whatever she could get her hands on in small town Mexico. And so at that point, I'm like, well, we got to get this kid an instrument. And so when she went back and she's coming back to the United States again, she came back for college auditions and she did fantastically well at those auditions. She ended up getting into Curtis and she needs an oboe. So I was like, well, let me go back to GoFundMe and see if we can raise money for an oboe. And we did very, very quickly. Within 3 hours, I had the funding for an oboe and I actually had some leftover. So with that leftover money, I've decided that I want to continue work like for students like Fatima. And I also think it's really important to get some new pieces out there so that we can play things that are outside of that canon, right? Outside of this, when we play the oboe, we have 30 pieces we basically study as students. And I think it's really exciting for people to work with composers. I think that we need so much more music from so many different voices. And so that's what I'm hoping to use this very small amount of money to continue work on. Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a few elements to the story that are so amazing. I mean, for one thing, that in 3 hours, you could raise thousands of dollars.
Yeah, it's sort of shocking, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And also that Fatima was able to get into Curtis. It's one of the most exclusive music schools in the world.
It is. And she is extremely gifted. And, you know, I'm sure people are going to say, well, I was at the audition. We had an audition behind a screen. We had 3 rounds. And 2 of them were behind a screen. So you can say, hey, the 3rd round wasn't behind a screen. I would definitely complain about that at an orchestra audition. But, you know, she made her way from behind the screen and was very compelling, not just to me. I was not the only person on the committee. And, you know, she's been very successful at Tanglewood as well. She's a joy to teach. And she will do more in a week, you know, hands-on, with good training than a lot of people will do in a year because she's so motivated and the fire is so strong. And maybe that comes from having to fight, right? Having to fight for education. Sometimes, like my kids, I can never get them to practice, right? Because I'm always there like, let me help you practice. Let me take you to your cello lesson. And that doesn't go over so well. They're not very motivated, but it seems very different in her case.
Mm-hmm. Actually, this comes up often with my guests who are parents. I have 2 grown kids, but I certainly went through this in terms of arts education. Do you think it's a challenge that they have this accomplished professional musician as a mom? Do they compare themselves to you?
No. I mean, my kids have no desire to be professional musicians. Maybe this is sad, but I have not, I guess, presented a view of the profession that led them to say, oh, I want to do that too. You know, oh, I want to play in an orchestra. So my son doesn't really talk about what he wants to do yet because he's only 9. But my daughters are both in high school and they both have academic interests. I mean, sort of political academic interests. And that's great, right? That's their thing. Certainly they've been studying music since they were young and I do kind of force them to do it now just because
that's what I was wondering about.
I force them to do math and other things that they don't want to do. And I think probably when they go to college, they won't do it, but maybe they'll change their mind. But they have a good education in music, so they can do with it what they want. It's their choice.
And for yourself, somewhere you were writing, you know, of course, I've read so much of your writing.
Sorry, there's a lot of crazy stuff out there.
There's a lot of material.
Though
when you were 15, you were at the Baltimore School of Arts, you performed what you consider maybe to be your best performance of the Mozart oboe quartet.
Yeah, probably.
Because after that performance got more fraught with anxiety. Do you want to speak
to that? Yeah, or fraught with, you know, when we're always fighting in classical music for everything, right? Like for this job and that job and to get paid $200 for something that's, you know, like thousands of hours of work. And I didn't realize any of that then, right? I just loved the music and went and played it. Just not really for anybody. So I think that's kind of the most pure way to approach it. So I think I probably did better that time than any of the other times. Although I probably play, you know, better in tune now or, you know, with the, you know, more control or something like that.
Yeah. It's interesting. You weren't playing for anybody, just for the enjoyment of the music.
Yeah. Well, and it's, I mean, that piece, if you're a 15-year-old oboe player, that piece is like amazing. Mm-hmm. It's wild. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's like there's nothing that could be more awesome than that, really, I think, if you're a 15-year-old oboe nerd. So.
Yeah, I used to play oboe for actually in high school.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, so, then you know. You know, it's got the high F and it's got the cut time and the 6/8. It's insane. Awesome.
Well, what I could relate to when you have a video when you're talking about getting in shape quickly, which I could really relate to because you know that there's different sort of seasons of your playing in every month, probably in every year, and that when you need to increase a lot of resistance, use a very thick reed, right?
Oh, yeah, if I'm preparing for a recital or something and I just need to get back in shape quickly sometimes, yeah. It's like basically lifting weights, you know, use a maybe heavier reed than I would actually want to use in real life.
Yeah, I found that very interesting, actually. Well, I think it relates to other instruments, probably singers. I mean, there's a way to increase resistance in order to be more efficient.
Right? Yeah, I mean, when we play the oboe, you just have to be really flexible. I mean, I don't really have a frame of reference for playing anything else at this level, but everything is always changing on the oboe every day. And mm-hmm. if you're not willing to kind of accept that and go with it and say, well, I got to make the best of this, you're going to be totally screwed because, you know, one day your reed is one way, one day the reed is another way. The instrument cracks and then changes and is never the same ever again. But I think the reeds especially are so finicky that you have to kind of exert your own force of will over it. So I do try to practice on kind of everything just so that I know how to deal with it when it comes.
How much has that reed making machine you bought changed your time? You say it doesn't save you time, but it must.
No, it kind of reduces my stress level. No, because I still spend a lot of time getting them just right or going through and picking out which one is which. But I don't sharpen knives anymore. It makes it so I don't have to sharpen knives anymore, which is awesome because I spent a really sick amount of time sharpening knives for like a normal adult human before. Like no one should spend that kind of time sharpening knives. So that's awesome that I don't have to do that. And I just kind of do final finishing work because of this machine I have. That's been really nice for me. It allows me to be pickier about certain things. It's fun.
How many reeds do you feel you need to make every week in order to have a good choice?
I try to make about two or three a week, which is actually a very low amount. I think most oboe players would tell you they spend a lot more time and make a lot more reeds. But I try to make two or three good ones, and I try not to waste any time just to get that done. Mm-hmm. And my reeds last a pretty long time too. So, you know, I have plans to make them last long. And, you know, so I can use the reeds from this week or the reeds from last week or the reeds from last month. And, you know, somewhere in there I hope to find something acceptable if I combine that with my skills of being able to kind of play on anything. Usually I can hopefully show up in public without making an embarrassing noise or something, you know.
I was charmed in that video where you show your reed making journal, you know, so meticulous, which you have to be, I understand. You wrote down, you said, and now I'm going to write down, and it's like the exact length of the...
Oh, yeah, that's new for me. That's like...
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah, I've only been doing that for about a year. But a lot of people do it, and yeah. You know, everybody has a different way. Some people have a really messy reed table and no organization at all, and some people are super organized and number all of their reeds and, you know, make Excel spreadsheets and stuff. I've usually been on the sort of messy, disorganized end of things. That's kind of my way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you have such attention to detail in the work you do, showing the inequalities in our music, classical music world. You know, just this idea of doing collages, you know, of look at this faculty at this university and look at this festival. Did you get that idea from somebody?
You know, this started, you mentioned 2021. I started with a collage that was basically made by the Pacific Music Festival.
Okay.
And I put it out on the internet. I just screenshot like the whole mm-hmm. faculty. I didn't make anything myself. Mm-hmm. They did it. And it was like one woman and some huge number of faculty members. And this is funny because I had been kind of talking about this stuff and I've been certainly talking about the Pacific Music Festival and nobody cared. And somehow I just put those pictures up there and it blew up and there was this huge response. And I was like, really? You guys are surprised by this? You find this unacceptable? Like I found that unacceptable forever. I've known about this forever. But somehow when people see it laid out without words, I think words can be sort of offensive and threatening to people sometimes, but just the picture allows people to see what they want to see, right? It's easy for me as a white woman to see, oh, look, there are no men. But very many of these collages also, there are all kinds of other people missing too, right? You have a huge lack of gender diverse people. You have very few black and brown people in these photos commonly as well. So just putting these collages out there allows people to kind of see themselves or the lack of themselves. And somehow I think it's a little less threatening. And so when I started these collages, that was before I started using words. Now I'm much more threatening with words. But this was my my toe in the water, these collages.
You write so well. You have such excellent turns of phrase and you're very funny. Have you been writing as a hobby?
No, I'm not a writer at all.
Really? I mean, you don't think of yourself that way?
No, I'm just an oboe player. I mean, that's how I started. I think that everything we do in music is about communication, though, in some way, right? I was always good at spelling in school. I was always really good at spelling. Like, I noticed this week at work, one of the titles of the pieces that I'm playing is misspelled. Like, I'm that kind of person, but I'm definitely not a writer. I didn't graduate from high school, so, I mean, I'm not particularly educated. But I do what I can to get my message out there, and I write as well as I can. I go back and proofread, not always perfectly.
So you were able to go to Curtis directly from high school?
Right, I left. Didn't finish high school, and I went to Curtis, yeah.
Yeah, I know a few people who've had the same experience.
Oh, tons of them. I mean, at Curtis, tons of them, yeah.
What was that experience like for you overall?
Curtis? Yeah. Well, I would say, first off, it was amazing to be around so many musicians because I had not been around people who took music as seriously as I did until I went to Curtis. I mean, a few, but not a whole school of them. And that was awesome. And I met some people that are my best friends still, like people that I just love. I met so many really wonderful people there. And I would say the most that I learned there actually was from those people, from my friends and from my peers. You can't really replace being in an environment like that. It's really remarkable. Looking back on it, there were actually a lot of problems that I was only minimally conscious of at the time. And so now I'm sort of much more aware of them. You know, there were no women faculty in the woodwind department when I was a student there. So we really had this god complex about the teachers there. They were gods, but they were also all white men. That was just how it was. And that was so normal for me that it took me a while to realize it. And I somehow I understood that I was not that, but I didn't understand why I was not that. And so there was a bit of a learning curve there. I mean, I think there were really some things that in the profession that were just not open to me on the basis of my gender. And we still see that a generation later. We still see the highest echelons of oboe in this country and in the world really are not occupied by women. The principal chairs and the very biggest orchestras have never been occupied by women. So, but you know, as we had this god complex with the teachers there, I tried to teach differently. Let me put it that way. I tried to teach differently than I was taught. And I'm very conscious about that at this point.
Mm-hmm. And what ways do you do that differently, do you think?
I guess I'm more analytical. And I have more of a plan. I like to present the students with a plan and I like to engage them in that plan. Like, what do you want to do? What do you want to accomplish? How are we going to accomplish that? With what repertoire are we going to accomplish that? I try to keep it a very positive experience, although like learning an instrument is really hard and it's not always positive and you have to really look kind of critically at what you're doing. But I still try to keep that as positive as possible. I've had a lot of trouble being on stage, maybe as a result of my education. And I don't want it to be scary for anyone. I mean, I think music in its ideal form is like a beautiful thing and it's a beautiful profession. So I try to help them as much as I can, you know, whether that's be comfortable or come up with a plan for playing the way they want to play. I'm really trying to help them with what they want to achieve, their individual goals. And, you know, I think because we often start so young there, there were basically the three grandfathers or, I don't know, the paternal trio of oboe came from Curtis. It was Marcel Tabuteau, the great Marcel Tabuteau, and he was the principal oboe of the Philadelphia Orchestra, and his student was John DeLancey, same thing, and then his student was Richard Woodhams, my teacher, same thing, and I think that they all taught in this same kind of way. And then Woodhams' student did not succeed him at the Philadelphia Orchestra. So now we have a totally new thing there, and I'm working with the teacher there, and I really like him a lot. I think he's great, but it's a totally different thing. So we have a little bit of a different way now, and I think that that's a good thing. I think that sometimes you have to be able to reflect on what you learned and what was good about it and what you learned and what you wish you hadn't learned and or what you wish that you learned instead. So I'm always trying to think about what would have been more helpful to me as a student. Mm-hmm.
We had talked a little bit before about composing, which is relatively new for you. I listened to a couple of your compositions on YouTube, and I really like the quartet. I'm trying to remember. Oh, yeah, The Land Where My Fathers Died.
Uh-huh.
So I understand the first performance, unfortunately, didn't get professionally recorded.
No.
But you do have one where it was recorded.
I do, yeah. Those are with some great colleagues of mine from Baltimore. I'm so lucky that they took it so seriously and so well. They did such a great job with it.
Could we include a clip of that and then link the real video in the description?
Oh, sure, of course.
Wonderful, thanks.
You're about to hear an excerpt from Land Where My Fathers Died, composed by Catherine Needleman. The link to this complete performance is in the show notes. This is a live performance from Community Concerts at Second in Baltimore from March 2024, with Agnes Tse on violin, Karen Brown on viola, Lachesar Kostov on cello, and Catherine Needleman on oboe.
So writing that piece, were you, do you compose at the piano when you do that kind of thing to hear
the harmonies? Yeah, typically, yeah. Just it helps me harmonically. It helps me to like put my hands on it, you know. Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. Well, you were just talking about difficulty on stage, and I was curious what you do to cope with stage fright in terms of your pre-concert, you know, your routines before you go on stage. Or
yeah, I don't have any good answers for it. I still don't have any good answers for it. Sometimes we just have to accept, I guess, that things will either go well or not well, or any range in between of that, right? It can either go really well or really terribly. I don't have any solutions. I've been looking for solutions. I'm sure you'll have 8,000 suggestions of solutions, you know, how we deal with stage fright, how we deal with performing, this whole idea of performing, which is for me fraught, right? Because I'm not really, I'm not that kind of person, really. I'm not like a performer, right? I'm someone in a party, like I kind of sit in the corner, like I'd be kind of happy to sit in the corner and, you know, have a couple drinks so that I don't feel that I'm there anymore, or play on my phone or something. But like having to actually perform in some way is not always the most comfortable thing for an introverted person, you know? So yeah, I don't have any solutions. I don't have any solutions. One thing that my teacher did say that was super helpful to me actually, about stage fright, maybe it's the most helpful thing he ever said, actually, was that once you embarrass yourself on stage enough, you become less scared. And so I've had like so many things go wrong and so many things go badly that it's not so terrifying to me anymore. Like, at least nobody dies, you know, if I screw up.
Hi, just a quick break from the episode. You may also be interested in my episodes with Anna Peterson, Gail Archer, Omo Bello, Karen Donnelly, Renee Yoxon, and Jessica Cottis. They're all linked in the show notes. It's a joy to be able to bring these meaningful conversations to you, but this project cost me quite a bit of money and lots of time. Please support the series through either my merchandise store or on my Ko-fi page. You'll find the links in the show notes. For the merch, it features a unique design by artist Steffi Kelly, and you can browse clothes, notebooks, water bottles, and more, everything printed on demand. You'll also find the link to sign up for my newsletter, where you'll get access to exclusive information about upcoming guests. Now back to Catherine Needleman.
I was curious about those solo lockdown concerts you did. Uh-huh. I think a lot of us engage in that sort of thing at the beginning of the pandemic. And it's a different kind of feeling with the audience, right?
Oh, no, I felt the audience in those. I absolutely felt the audience because I knew afterwards they would leave comments. No, I felt like they were a real performance, actually, to me, even though they were in my living room.
Or on a raft in the middle of a lake.
That one actually wasn't a real performance.
Right.
That I had to broadcast. It. Yeah. Because the internet wasn't good enough. But the others were live. And so, I felt just like a real performance for those.
Yeah, and I mean, you just have such a singing, like it seems to me when you play, you're just so in the music and so unselfconscious and just have such a lyrical, beautiful quality to your playing.
Oh, thank you. That's very nice. Thank you.
And then when you jump off the raft at the end of that particular concert, you know, I was thinking about you as an athlete, because I think there's another post you did where you wished you'd realized when you were younger how important it was to work out and work on fitness and strength.
Yeah, I'm definitely not an athlete, really. I mean, wow. I can do certain things, but I'm not any kind of athlete. Although I did have a doctor call me an athlete a couple years ago, and I was so happy. It was because I run, you know, basically to cope with being on stage. And I had injured... what's a nice way to put it? I had injured something in one of my glutes. I call it my ass. I injured my ass. And it was really painful.
Yeah.
And I couldn't, you know, and it was bothering me for months and months. And I went to the sports medicine doctor and she said, oh, well, it's, you know, it's because you're 44 years old and you're an athlete and you've been running a long time. And I'm like, I'm not an athlete. She's like, oh, well, compared to the general population, you are. So I did feel good about that. But I wouldn't really classify myself as an athlete. I don't typically do any more than a half an hour of something a day.
But you didn't always do that, like when you're younger?
No, it never occurred to me. No one ever told me to, but I tell my students to now. No, I mean, playing the oboe or violin or whatever, it's like, it's kind of bad for your body, isn't it? To be stuck in that weird position, doing these weird things forever. And then when we play the oboe, we're always like hunched over like this, scraping reeds with the reed right in our face. It's so bad for you that you need to actually go move your body in a healthy way and keep all the stuff working.
Catherine, what kind of advice do you give your students about auditions and different types of auditions, like for schools as opposed to orchestra auditions?
Orchestra auditions are very fraught, I think. For oboe especially, they're tricky because historically the biggest principal positions have not been filled by these blind auditions. But that said, you have to be able to do well in these blind auditions to even get to a spot where you might be invited somewhere. I think ultimately these blind auditions are not testing what we're looking for to play principal oboe in an orchestra. They might be testing the appropriate skills for a second oboe player somewhat, but there's so many skills that you need in a first oboe player that I do not think are particularly well tested by playing standard excerpts behind a screen. We have this issue. That said, you know, I tell my students, look, you have to be really rhythmically accurate, and when you stretch the time or move the time, it has to be quite calculated in a way that isn't something we would do in a real performance a lot of the time. Like, you have to make it very obvious, like, I'm taking time here because and this is the kind of time I'm taking, and it's very tasteful, and I'm still a very rhythmic person even though I'm taking time. You know, the intonation has to be really perfect. The sound, I advise them not to try to push it too far. That the oboe behind a screen seems to do best when it's played within kind of a small pretty range. And anything that's pushed, like we actually have to do in real life to be successful as like a character role in an orchestra, that kind of sound often does not do well behind a screen. So I encourage them to kind of keep the sound within a certain quality profile. So those things I think are really important, the sound and the intonation and the rhythm. So I advise them to focus on that in a way that they wouldn't perhaps in a real performance where engaging the audience in an expressive way is obviously the most paramount thing when you're actually in a room with an audience who are there to enjoy you, right? It's quite different than when you're playing with a screen in front of you for 9 people who are there to vote yes or no. It's kind of a different thing. And if I'm preparing students for a like audition for a school or something like that, that's very different because you're not trying to get a yes or no vote. You're trying to convince someone about the value of what you have to say. So that's much more performance oriented. I would approach that with a student like I would approach playing a recital or something.
Yeah.
That said, when you go play the orchestra audition, you have to present it as if you're playing a recital, right? It has to seem very natural and all of this, but you have to have all of these boxes ticked in a way that you don't when you play a recital. If you play a recital as an oboe player, you play for an hour or 90 minutes or whatever. There's not so much riding on each note in a recital, right? If one goes astray, it's not such a big deal in a way that it can be in an orchestra audition.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the first time you were sitting on the other side of the screen as a member of the jury and what that felt like?
I don't remember. That's crazy. It must have been at the Baltimore Symphony a long time ago, but I don't remember.
Yeah.
That's how unmusical of an experience it is for me. It's something I don't have an answer for. I don't have an answer for the whole audition thing. I think it should be fair. I think the way that we hire people needs to be more fair than it is. I have a lot of problems with it now. I feel quite strongly that playing excerpts behind a screen is not a way to really judge an artistic character. So I don't have a great solution for this whole thing yet.
In Baltimore, do you have trial weeks?
We do. Sometimes. I believe the contract now has changed. Originally, I don't think it was required when I joined the orchestra 21 seasons, 22, I don't even know how many seasons ago that I've been here. And then at some point, it became the go-to with the audition that most auditions would lead to a trial week, and then you would hire or not hire someone based upon that. And we've done basically everything in Baltimore, so they have that kind of trial week. And then we've had tons of failed auditions where they then just invite people in. And of course, this is a very fraught process. You know, when you just invite people to solo chairs, it's been done for decades, for generations. But is it the most fair way? I don't know. Probably not.
I think the Met Orchestra is one of the only ones I've heard of where they have to hire at the end of auditions, right?
I think so. I think that's correct. Yeah.
But people,
although
don't
they just had an oboe audition for two spots and they only hired one, so I don't know the details of how that works. So maybe they did hire, but not two.
Maybe that's changed. Yeah. It's definitely a difficult process. And I did like your recent post as we're recording this. It was recent about you thought your audition was blind, or however you put it, like pointing out all the ways that things aren't truly blind.
No. Yeah, they're not.
Yeah.
So you have to really, if you want it to be fair, you have to trust that the people judging it are fair and reasonable and as unbiased as possible. And that's really hard.
Yeah. Have you had some positive reactions from some of the men who read your essays doing the kind of change we need, where they push back and say, hey, why aren't there more, why isn't there more representation on this festival or this sort of thing, where there is ability to have changes made?
I mean, I get some nice notes here and there. I hear mostly women talking on the behalf of their husbands who do this, which is always like a little weird for me. I haven't actually seen anybody say, no, I'm not going to do this because there are not enough women involved, or, oh, there are not enough black or brown people involved. I haven't seen that happen yet, but I'm open to learning about it. I hope it does happen.
Yeah.
This idea that I pose so often is not my idea at all. It comes from Francis Collins, who is the head of the NIH, and he said that he was going to stop participating in mammals, he called them. And if he didn't see appropriate representation when he was asked to speak, he was going to decline to speak. And I think that's really allyship at its best. And so I try to hold him up here and there, because I think that idea is so inspirational. But that said, I haven't really seen a lot of concrete evidence of it happening yet.
And NIH?
Yeah, National Institutes of Health. Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay,
yeah.
in the States. Okay.
Yeah. It's our big institute. It's right down the street here in Bethesda, Maryland.
Okay. Well, what do you think about in terms of building audiences in the orchestral community? I feel like there's an absence of including soloists from the orchestra, in general, in terms of making those connections that people feel like they feel connected to the orchestra members, and it's all about bringing in fancy soloists people know.
Yeah, this is very interesting. Wow, that's a great question. So, of course, I'm all for that. but maybe I'm a biased party here. I think it's great for the musicians to get that opportunity. And in my experience with, for example, the social media of the Baltimore Symphony musicians, when we share videos of our own players playing solos, the very few who get to do that each year, these posts are often wildly popular. So, I mean, I do think the audience enjoys it. I think the audience eats these people up. And it was explained to me, you know, because I have all these ideas of what I would like to play, of course, that very rarely happens. But I was explained, oh, well, we don't have orchestra soloists that often because we need to have the big names in to sell tickets, right? And so Yo-Yo Ma was here this year, and Yo-Yo Ma sells tickets, like, there's no doubt. But we also had James Ennis here this year, our opening week, and it didn't sell well at all. And he's one of the great violinists, right? So we've had all kinds of similarly great, amazing soloists that don't sell. So I don't know what, I guess nobody knows what the audience really wants, right? If we knew what the audience really wanted, then we wouldn't have budget problems. But when I see these things happen, you know, when they're paying, you know, tens of thousands of dollars for a soloist and it still doesn't sell well, I think, well, maybe they should have an orchestra soloist. That's much cheaper and the audience likes it just as much or better, right? So I think there's probably an appropriate balance for that. But this is the perennial problem. I mean, I've been hearing about my whole involvement in classical music is dying and nobody's coming to concerts. So how do we get them in the door? And no one has been able to answer that yet.
There's a beautiful recording you made, which I really found very touching, of Kevin Putz's concerto that he wrote.
And I love that piece. Yes, beautiful.
The Moonlight Concerto.
So beautiful, yeah.
So Marin Alsop, I think, is conducting, and she worked with you for many years.
Right. I mean, we worked together in the Baltimore Symphony since she became the music director. Well, before that. I think she became the music director in 2007, maybe, something like that. So quite a while.
Mm-hmm. And did, like, for me, the first 20 years, I've been an orchestra musician for about 30 years. I'd say the first 20 years, almost never saw a woman on the podium. And then it was honestly a little shocking. And I kind of recognized my own bias because I was just so, it was such an unusual thing. Now, thankfully, it's very common and normal. But yeah, it struck me at the time. I thought, why am I reacting this way? It's really strange.
Right, because we expect certain things to be men, right? Mm-hmm. Or we expect, I was talking about the A today and giving the A and how people, some men don't like to take the A from a woman because they're supposed to come to us, right? It's like we deliver the pitch and then they're supposed to move to that, right? And that can be really offensive to some people. And maybe it would be less offensive if that's another man giving it to a man, but sometimes men have trouble taking the A from a woman. And we're discussing like the disrespectful things that can fall out from that. But in terms of the conductor and what we expect, it's absolutely what we've seen. And in some ways I was lucky because you say you've seen very few women or you hadn't for the first 20 years. And I was telling you at Curtis, I didn't have any men teachers. I also didn't have any men conductors except for one. They brought in one guest conductor for 1 week.
You said men, but you meant women.
No. I'm sorry. I saw only men. And then 1 week of all of those men, I saw one woman. And that was Marin Alsop.
Okay.
So Marin Alsop was on my radar since I was a child, basically. I was a teenager. And I mean, I played for her then. And then she became the music director of my orchestra. But I hadn't played for any other women conductors, very rarely, or not of that level, right? Not at that echelon of the profession. I hadn't played for any of them. And so it was Marin as a teenager, and then it was Marin in my 20s when I was in the Baltimore Symphony. And we had years and years and years where Marin was the only woman on the podium of the Baltimore Symphony until quite recently, right? Now we see more of them, and I really like working with women conductors. The occasions that I've had to play solo with women conductors, it's always been a really wonderful experience for me. Not that I want to be biased towards them, but for whatever reason, it's been really nice. But Marin has been kind of the one, right? Or at least the one in my career forever. And at least until I was 40, I really didn't see other women conductors either. And I think I was just lucky that I had that one. Mm.
And if we look at orchestras, certainly in North America, I don't know what the scene is like elsewhere. It's still a big problem.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that orchestras like to tout themselves as like really great for women conductors because they have three of them now. They have a season of, I don't know, 38 weeks. What do people program? 30 weeks, 38 weeks of classical programming, and they'll have 3 weeks with three different women conductors, and they think this is some achievement. I mean, was it last year or 2 years ago, the Cleveland Orchestra? The Cleveland Orchestra had zero women conductors all year on subscription concerts. And then I think this year they have three. So yeah, it's really dismal, but it's not that they're not, again, in the pipeline, right? You see lots of women conducting students.
Yeah. One of the women brass players I know, we were talking about this stuff, and she was saying that she has heard from colleagues that they don't necessarily want to go for principal positions as brass players.
The women?
Yeah. Have you heard that?
I haven't. Why would they not want to?
I don't know. Maybe they don't want to deal with all the men.
Or do they, you know, in that position. They think the men won't hire them. I don't know. I haven't heard that one, but that sucks.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the Queen of Filth Digest.
Sure.
So hard to read. So just heartbreaking, so much of it. And I know you don't publish everything you get, and it must be so hard to sift through.
Yeah, I am so behind. Also, I mean, I haven't published one since, it might be August. I'm really, really behind. I have I mean, I think I have like 160 posts, messages out there, and I probably have another 160 that I need to organize that I just haven't dealt with. And, you know, it's so hard because I have to go back and forth and say, can I share this? Can I not share this? Can I, you know, what needs to go out? What needs to stay in? You know, how can I do this without getting myself sued? A lot of people want to just call somebody's name out, but they're not willing to use their own name. And that's a recipe for me getting sued. So I don't do that, even though I wish I could. Yeah, it's a lot. There's a lot of stuff there.
How do you deal with it on a personal level? Like, it's just so hard to.
Yeah. Well, I've been like not dealing with it right now. Right. It's like, it's piled up in my inbox. I feel bad just because like, I can't communicate with everyone that I want to communicate with on a reasonable level. I was late to be with you today. You know, I definitely can't handle it all. For sure.
Are you getting some help from people behind the scenes?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, I did have someone lovely helping me, but she needs to do her own thing and she's busy and I'm not going to saddle this on anyone. And I also have to be really careful. Like, I can't just let anybody have access to my inbox. So it has to be someone I really trust. So it's just me. That's it.
I think, you know, everyone respects that. And you have to have boundaries at a certain point.
Oh, not everyone respects it. No, I mean, I have people go off like I'm Satan because I haven't responded appropriately or, you know, something sat in the inbox and it's like, I'm sorry. I really try my best. But yes, it's just me.
Yeah. Well, thank you for doing that work. Like many people, you know, I read the stuff and I don't comment. Partly I think I don't want Catherine to have to read another comment. She has so much to do.
Oh, no, don't worry. Yeah, no, I love the comments. And I don't get through all of them, but I love them. I mean, the ones that I read and some of them I hate, which is also great because sometimes they spark discussion and sometimes they show the problems in the world. And I think the comments are great.
So not everyone listening to this will know why this moniker Queen of Filth and what this is. So maybe you could just talk a little bit to what these messages are you're getting. And
yeah. So the Queen of Filth Digest is something I started shortly after Kara Kaiser's story hit the New York Press or the New York Magazine on April 12th of this year. And all these people started sharing their stories with me. I mean, people had been sharing their stories, but the inbox got kind of flooded with them, I think because of my coverage of that story. And so then I started asking people, hey, can I share this without your name? And so I just started putting these digests out of people talking about their experiences in classical music. And some of them are as harrowing or worse than Kara's. And some of them are much less bad, right? Some of them are just garden variety sexism and misogyny. But I think they often speak to the condition or the experiences of marginalized people and in classical music. And it's certainly not all women that I'm sharing. I mean, it's not always clear who I'm sharing from, but you know, maybe it's majority women, but it's not just women, they're men. I've shared from many trans people, a number of non-binary people. I really do get the gamut of races and genders sharing these stories, but of course it's not always obvious to the reader, but I think it just speaks to kind of the difficulties of our profession. Mm-hmm. That it's not just about how well you play your instrument in the pipeline, you know?
Yeah, and of course there's this danger with people having these, you know, private lessons as children and teenagers where there's no safeguards.
Yeah, absolutely. It's rife with the potential for problems.
In terms of sort of, you might be qualified as microaggressions, I really enjoyed your piece, The Mandatory Dress.
Uh-huh.
Really related to it, and it's funny, it's hilarious to me you kept that dress too.
It is. I just laughed when I found it. I was like, oh my God, look at this thing. And then I wore it and it was still uncomfortable just because I couldn't open my legs wide enough to play. And people were like, well, I don't know how cellists could play in it. But the good news is they didn't have women cellists. So it wasn't an issue.
So could you explain the context of why the women had to buy this dress?
Oh yeah. So we had this lady and I didn't know her name, but it's been pointed out to me. Promptly forgotten it, but I could look it up. She was the executive director of the orchestra, and I played in this orchestra in Philadelphia that is now called the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia. And at the time, it was Concerto Soloists Chamber Orchestra, It was Mark Mostafoy's group, and it was just transitioning to this new name. I'm not sure where in the time frame this happened, but this lady, this executive director, decided that the women were dressed too sloppily. And I mean, the women playing in this orchestra, well, at least I was not making very much money. I mean, like, real, not a lot of money. It didn't pay a living wage at all. And, you know, we're always looking for the next meal when we're a young classical musician or a freelancer. And so she knew that she couldn't insist that we wear classier clothing. So she knew she had to provide it. So she went to some fancy store on Philadelphia's main line. And at the time, they told us this dress was a $600 dress. And everybody's like, that's not a $600 dress. It looks like crap. Anyway, that's what they told us. And we had to get this dress altered to fit. So it was one dress that's supposed to fit all the women in the orchestra, which were many different sizes of women and pregnant women and not pregnant women and playing different instruments. And it was just insane. And I remember I was incensed that I had to spend like, was it $60 or $80 getting this dress altered, which was a huge amount of money. I never paid anyone to alter clothes for me, but the thing didn't fit at all. It was way too huge for me. And so they wanted me to return this dress when I left, and I was like, no, screw this. I'm not returning that dress. I spent $80 getting altered, but of course I didn't want to wear the thing, so it sat in my closet for the next 24 years or something, and then I found it a couple of months ago and wore it for a concert.
If I'm not mistaken, when I joined my orchestra, we still had gendered dress codes, which we don't anymore.
Well, that's good. I think we still do.
Yeah, although they're not called gendered, but they basically are. But anyway, the women, I think we were required to wear dresses instead of pants, but everyone ignored it. But
oh, that's good.
Somebody came from another orchestra from a different city, and she actually said she was shocked because she thought it looked so bad for women to be wearing pants. And I was really
shocking.
Yeah, I was really surprised that she would have that, you know, my peer would have that attitude. Anyway, thank goodness things have changed. But
do you know, there was an article in the New York Times relatively recently about the Philharmonic releasing its dress code for the women.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that? I'm looking it up right now. In 2018, the New York Philharmonic updated their dress code in 2018 to allow women to wear pants on stage.
Well, let's talk about a wonderful American composer, Jennifer Higdon.
Uh-huh.
So your performance of her aria for oboe and piano is very beautiful. I hope that was another piece of music we could include.
Oh, it's fine with me if it's okay with Jennifer. Yeah.
Yeah, I can check with her. We've played her music before. Like, I knew the name, but I never looked up who she was, just like one of these names that goes by. So I was looking her up and I'm like, wow, what an inspirational, interesting person.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, we were talking about Marin and how Marin had been like the woman conductor of my adolescence and, you know, young adulthood. And Jennifer Higdon was the woman composer for me because I went to Curtis. I actually was in Jennifer Higdon's class and she ran a great class at Curtis. I don't remember the name of it. It was like 20th century music or something like that, which sounds old, but I was in school in the 20th century. So that meant modern music, right? 20th century music. And she really had an inspirational class about new music and the value of composers, and this relationship of the composer and the performer. So I've known Jennifer forever. I spent an embarrassing amount of my career playing virtually no music by women composers, but I did play Jennifer Higdon's, you know, quintet work, was one of them. I played her oboe concerto before I kind of got clued into how pathetic my repertoire was. So again, she was that sort of lone woman composer in a certain way for me, and I've known her really forever at this point.
Mm-hmm. Great.
You're about to hear an excerpt of Jennifer Higdon's aria for oboe and piano with Catherine Needleman and Jennifer Lim. I did get in touch with the composer who's happy to have this music shared as part of this podcast. The video of this live performance is on Catherine Needleman's YouTube channel and is linked directly in the show notes.
Is there anything you've changed your mind about with all this exposure you've had to the realities of what's going on in classical music?
Yeah. Yeah. There is something I've changed my mind about. I was raised in, probably from Curtis era or before, in this culture that we have to be nice, right? And that's the most important thing for women in order to get work, or maybe for men too, in order to get work, in order to be successful, is that we have to be nice, we have to be good colleagues, and we have to have people like us, right? That's what success looks like. And I've really given that up. So, everyone says, well, you know, your tone is bad, and, you're strident, and you're shrill, or you're not polite. And I know, like, that's by design. You know, like, I'm past that. I think it's actually really detrimental. So that's something that's changed for me.
Good. For people who aren't, not everyone listening will know who you are, be familiar with your social media presence. From the beginning, I just found it so funny, these sort of, I don't know, the style of selfies you have with your drink, because you know you have to have a photo. It's kind of like your brand.
Again, I told you I'm like a really introverted person. I had avoided my face and all of this. I was never a person who posted a selfie. And now I have all these men talking about how narcissistic and arrogant I am because I have these, like, I'm in this very location, right? These very unmade up pictures of me with a glass of tea or whatever. But they've really increased my presence in the algorithm, these stupid selfies. So I keep doing it. And I love that it offends people. Right? Like, who is offended by an unattractive picture of, like, a middle-aged half-Jewish woman? It's like, it's really kind of non-offensive, right? It's not like I'm trying to be this or that in these photos, but it really is quite offensive to people. So.
And, you know, especially during the pandemic, so many musicians went online to try to, you know, really grow their presence and hope to chase that elusive, you know, YouTube dollar, which maybe doesn't exist, but and the way
I've never made 1 cent on YouTube. I'm waiting.
Yeah, I haven't either.
I have like more than the magical 1,000. Like, you need 1,000 followers. I have more than that, and I still have made like 0 cents.
Well, as of this recording, I'm 2 hours away from the 3,000 hours you need within a certain number of days of people viewing your content to make a penny. So we'll see.
Oh, that's awesome. You're going to make a penny.
But all to say, I find your presence so refreshing because you're very, it's an overused word, authentic, but really you are, because you're not like trying to have this carefully crafted video. You're just like, here's my lunch. This is what I do for my routine. It's just very like, you know, 2012.
Yeah, I'm pretty disorganized in a lot of ways. So.
No, I think you're prioritizing the correct things, the correct use of your time, right?
Thank you. I'm trying. No, prioritizing is really important. That's something I tell my students, like, you gotta, and my kids too, you gotta prioritize.
You've played in other orchestras as principal oboe.
Mm-hmm.
What's that like to go into a completely different orchestra?
It's fine. It's kind of the same. I haven't done it for a while. I don't expect that I'm going to get called ever again to do that. Which is fine with me. It's like totally fine with me. But like that used, I think that's very important to a lot of people that they get called to go play here and there, when somebody gets sick. But I gave up on that idea a while ago. But it's, you do the same job. It's just, you know, everybody sounds a little bit different here and there, but, you know, we have this idea that the great orchestras are so great and the less great orchestras are not so great. And I don't really buy into that at this point. I think that we all have good days and we all have bad days, and each person within that ensemble has good days and bad days. And I've played in kind of a gamut of orchestras at this point, and I don't know that there's any one that's like really that much greater than the other.
Yeah. I was just wondering, because I mean, it is such a, when at its best, an orchestra does feel very much like an organism. And, you know, I'm a 2D player. I'm not a principal player. And I've never, since I, you know, I haven't played in another orchestra in so long, I can't imagine what that would be like to be plunked. Well, I've never been like just me going in to play, because I haven't freelanced in so long. So I was just kind of curious, especially as a principal player, what that would be like. But I guess like different blend within the section. And
well, you know, I mean, we're expert listeners, supposedly, right?
Yeah.
We're supposed to be good at listening, although some of us are like super incompetent at it, but we're about listening and judging and intuiting things about other people. So it is nice sometimes to get to do that with people that you don't know exactly where they're going to be. I mean, I play in a wonderful section in Baltimore. I'm really lucky. We have a wonderful wind section. I love it. But I kind of know where everybody's going to be now, you know, like, I expect this to happen. And if something else happens, then I know how to respond appropriately. So sometimes it's exciting to play with other people in that way. To be honest, you have a lot more flexibility sometimes if you're playing chamber music with people like outside of an orchestra, outside of that setting. I think sometimes you can learn more and more quickly with people or about people.
Yeah. I'm just curious about your perception of the music education ecosystem, because my impression talking to Americans is still pretty robust public music education opportunities.
Like, oh, wow. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's not my experience. I'm always hearing about how this and that are getting cut. Mm-hmm. And, you know, music study is really only for people who are financially privileged, right? That their parents can afford to take them to study with musicians. And this is expensive, right? To take music lessons is expensive. And I think that music is getting more and more cut from school systems. Yeah, that's not my impression here, that the public school system is particularly robust. That's where I learned. I am a product of the public school system. It's not my impression now.
Yeah, I mean, certainly in terms of private lessons, but I got the impression like you have this very robust marching band culture. People mm-hmm. have the opportunity to play string instruments in schools, which is pretty rare in Canada.
Sometimes, I think in Texas, actually, mm-hmm. the marching band culture is very big in certain places, like football schools.
Yeah.
But I think in Baltimore City, where I lived for the majority of my life, I don't think this is particularly strong. I don't think you're going to have a lot of kids growing up learning classical music from a young age in the school system. I don't think it happens here.
Yeah.
And in very many big cities, too. I think it's also a problem.
So to close this out, you know, I was thinking about all your different, you know, you were saying at the beginning you wear a lot of hats. I mean, we all have different identities. Do you find that your work as an activist and, you know, the keeper of the blog is sort of pushed out other parts of your life that are important? Like, it's hard to keep a balance. Do you see a way forward where you can do this work and keep everything going?
I think I can keep things going as they are now. I'm quite good at compartmentalization sometimes. You know, there's certain things, well, I guess I learned this in my job playing in an orchestra, like you have to kind of show up for that job no matter what, right? I mean, if you want to keep it, you have to show up in every possible state. And so I've learned a way to kind of separate myself from that in order to protect my ability to be a professional. And so I try to do that also with the blog, and I'm kind of behind on the Queen of Filth stuff, but you know, it's really easy to get caught up in it because a lot of it's horrible. And a lot of the stories are just appalling and never ending. And so at some point I do close myself off from it in the way that I do from playing the oboe in an orchestra sometimes, right? Like, you know, I can play the oboe like a professional, but I don't always put all of myself there in order to do that. I think we have to do that sometimes. Which isn't to say like that's not the kind of musician that I am, but sometimes when you're a professional, you have to just show up. And so I do have this ability to step back, I think, sometimes, which is helpful. And I do plan to keep going with the blog and the social media until I see other people doing it and until I see change happening. You know, maybe, you know, if we see some real tangible change happening, if I see women playing principal oboe in the big orchestras or concertmaster or principal trumpet, you know, something like that, then I can feel there's a change, and then maybe I don't need to do all the crazy online stuff. But I'm really pretty driven to do it right now. I don't have any plans to stop it.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciated it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Such a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support this series, that would be wonderful. or you can browse the collection of merch with a very cool, unique, and expressive design from artist Steffi Kelly, with notebooks, mugs, shirts, phone cases, and more. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. All the links are in the show notes. Have a wonderful week.